It is nearly 12 o'clock, and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. Broadcasting on 100.1 FM, it is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 32 degrees. A few clouds are drifting around. Out at the airport, they are showing southwest winds at 8 miles per hour. They have a full 10 miles of visibility and 64% humidity. The Weather Service is calling for sunny skies for the rest of the day, high near 35, southwest winds 20, gusting to 30. Increasing clouds overnight tonight with a low of 18, southwest winds to 10, and a chance of snow tomorrow with mostly cloudy skies, northwest winds to 15. Coming up on the Midday Report, much of the village of Quinnahawk has been without power since Friday. Research for a new hydro project in Bristol Bay is turning heads. And another lawsuit challenging the legality of the Manh Cho mine is slowly working its way through the court system. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Attorneys for a 31-year-old woman in Texas who sued for the right to terminate her non-viable pregnancy say their client has left the state. A district judge ruled in Kate Cox's favor last week, but the Texas Supreme Court put that decision on hold for an undetermined amount of time. Her attorneys say the mother of two has made repeated visits to the emergency room for medical complications and could no longer wait for a final ruling. They have not said where Cox is having the procedure. Cox's case has been one of the most closely watched since the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade last year. The Air National Guard has disciplined 15 individuals, ranging from sergeants to colonels, for failing to stop a young airman for disclosing classified information after they became aware of his activities. Here's NPR's Tom Bowman.
Airman First Class Jack Teixeira scribbled notes about classified information and was caught by superiors on at least four occasions. But he was allowed to remain in the job until he began posting damaging details about Ukrainian military activities, U.S. spy satellites, and North Korean drones on chat groups. Teixeira was arrested in April and is now facing multiple criminal charges. He pleaded not guilty. Pentagon officials are still trying to determine how the 21-year-old received a top-secret security clearance. He made threats at his high school in Massachusetts and was suspended. Then a local police department denied him a firearms identification card. Tom Bowman, NPR News.
Years of right-wing nationalist rule is coming to an end in Poland with the parliamentary backing of a liberal politician for prime minister. Here's NPR's Rob Schmitz.
After hours of parliamentary debate, the Polish parliament delivered a vote of no confidence in former Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki of the Law and Justice Party. It then voted 248 to 201 in favor of Donald Tusk leading a left-center coalition government. The transfer of power comes nearly 2 months after a record turnout of voters heralded the end of 8 years under Law and Justice rule.
A Minnesota man who spent more than half of his life in prison for murder has been freed. Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio reports a judge vacated Marvin Haynes' conviction.
Marvin Haynes had been serving a life sentence for the 2004 killing of 55-year-old Minneapolis flower shop owner Harry Randy Shearer. The victim's sister described the shooter as a 180-pound black male with short hair during the initial investigation, but police included Haynes, who was 16 at the time, in lineups, even though he was much smaller and had long hair. Now free after nearly two decades behind bars, Haynes thanked his sister Marvina and Great North Innocence Project attorneys for bringing his case back to court.
I'm just appreciative to be here and people to recognize my innocence, so I'm just grateful.
Haynes says he plans to look for a job and spend time with his family. For NPR News, I'm Matt Sepik in Minneapolis.
From Washington, this is NPR News.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
Support for KMXT comes from Alaska's most advanced network, GCI's resilient and redundant network is keeping schools connected across the state. Details at gci.com/education.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. The southern half of the village of Quinnahawk has been without power since Friday, including the tribal government buildings, airport, and post office. KYUK's Sunny Bean spoke to residents as temperatures dipped to near zero.
This is what it sounded like to try and reach many people in Quinnahawk over the weekend. Finally, Tribal Administrator Darren Cleveland picked up.
I don't know what happened. It's just that the generators gave out. We have three generators. One is working, and two generators are out. The last bit I got from one of the workers is that generator three needs parts. Number one still won't clear the warning lights, so they're working on getting number one going. Right now we have number two working, and that's only powering half of the village, and one generator can only support half the village, and south side, the other half of the village, has no power.
Quinnahawk's power plant is a part of the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, which provides electricity in towns across western Alaska. While AVEC runs electricity for the community, Quinnahawk School has its own generator and is open to the public. Cleveland said many teachers are sleeping there, but nobody from the public chose to stay the night. Still, he said residents are worried about the harsh cold engulfing the YK Delta.
Well, with the temperatures being below, wind chill below zero, the people that are on the south side are worried about their water and sewer being frozen, and there's homes that don't even have heating, so we're worried for them.
Many in the village of less than 1,000 are staying with family to get away from the cold. That includes Dorothy Mark. She arrived home from a trip Sunday afternoon to find her home without power. She went over to stay at her niece's, who has a generator.
I came home. All my family are at my niece, who got a generator going. My house is really cold. I just went over and came back. Too cold to be over there. People with no power here. Terrible. And it's cold. Below numbers.
With half the town in a blackout, Mark said it's a little crowded.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yeah, there's 8 of us there. But we're warm, so we're good.
Tribal Administrator Cleveland said, while this has been a particularly long outage, issues with power are becoming the norm in Quinnahawk.
Lately, we've been having power issues. Power going off and on, like it's becoming normal. Like come on, come, get on, get off, power on. Like, it's like becoming annoying.
Timothy Matthew, Quinnahawk's power plant operator, said a mechanic was in town Sunday evening working on the generators. Matthew said they hope to have one of the two broken generators repaired by Monday, which would bring power back to the south side of the community. In Bethel, I'm Sunny Bean.
Research for a new hydroelectric project in Bristol Bay is underway. Earlier this week, Dillingham's local utility cooperative held a meeting to present initial field study findings on the project's impact and provide opportunity for public comment. KDLG's Christina McDermott has more.
Dillingham's local utility provider in Michigan.
Oh, my. Let's move on. A lawsuit challenging the legality of the Manh Cho mine, or the Manh Cho mine ore haul, is slowly progressing through the court system. The suit filed by the local group Committee for Safe Communities against the Alaska Department of Transportation maintains the state is not following laws and regulations governing the use of public roads between the new gold mine in Tetlin and the Fort Knox mill north of Fairbanks. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, a key deadline in the case is coming up next week.
The complaint filed in October by the Committee for Safe Communities, or CSC, asserts that the ore haul is an industrial use and the state must designate the highways it traverses as such and require permits. It also challenges use of a designated truck route around Fairbanks, in part because the 95-foot-long ore haulers exceed a 75-foot limit for those roads. CSC's initial filing in October was followed by a request for a preliminary injunction to stop the ore haul at least until impact studies and resulting safety recommendations, including infrastructure upgrades, can be carried out. Moncho Mine operator Peak Gold subsequently requested and was granted intervening status in the case. In a filing opposing the preliminary injunction, Peak Gold claims a one-year delay could cost the project $60 to $65 million. A DOT filing contends the ore haul is no different from other commercial highway use, as it complies with existing Alaska truck weight and length statutes and regulations. It also says the ore trucks can use the Richardson and Steese highways directly through Fairbanks instead of the length-limited route around town. The DOT additionally maintains that asserted harms from the ore haul are speculative and do not meet the standard for a preliminary injunction. The Committee for Safe Communities has until next Monday, December 11th, to file its response to DOT's and Peak Gold's opposition. After that, Superior Court Judge Patricia Haynes could immediately rule on the preliminary injunction or order a hearing on the issue. The trucking of ore from the Moncho Mine at Fort Knox is currently in trial phase, but scheduled to ramp up to as many as 60 round trips per day in 2024. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska spends a lot of money on education, roughly 40% more than the national average per student. But research presented by the University of Alaska Anchorage's Institute of Social and Economic Research on Thursday suggests that number doesn't tell the whole story. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone has more.
It doesn't take much thinking. Anyone who's spent time in Alaska knows that things just cost more here, and education is no exception. But how much more? Dana DeFeo, who leads UAA's Center for Alaska Education Policy Research, tried to answer that with a study in 2022. She and her co-authors first looked at the state's so-called cost factor. That's part of the education funding formula that corrects for the higher cost of living in smaller rural communities. DeFeo and her team also adjusted for the fact that small schools are more costly per person to run.
And that adjustment alone, it's explained more than half of the difference between Alaska's spending and the national average.
So if you take into account the cost of living in, say, Unalakleet or Thorne Bay compared to Anchorage, Alaska spends about 20% more than the rest of the country on educating its kids. But, of course, prices in Anchorage are quite a bit higher than they are in the rest of the country. So DeFeo and her fellow researchers took a look at a widely used cost of living index and used that to make an apples-to-apples comparison.
And when we did that, we actually find that Alaska dips below the national average by 7 percentage points in 2019.
That is, after you consider the cost of gas, groceries, medical care, and school supplies, electricity, and everything else it takes to make an economy run, Alaska actually spends less per student than the rest of the country. And the gap has grown bigger in recent years. When they first looked at the question using 2017 data, Alaska's spending was just about on par with the national average. But Alaska's per-student spending grew 3% between 2017 and 2019. So how did the state fall further behind?
What that means is that other states are investing more in public education. They're doing it more and faster than we are. And I think that's going to be a big deal for Alaska.
Where is Alaska's school money going? Well, DeFeo points to three big drivers of rising costs. We've already talked about one, small schools. Small schools are just more expensive to run than bigger ones. Turnover is high, they have to pay higher wages to attract teachers, and they can't take advantage of shared resources in the way that larger districts can. Another is healthcare. Even outside of education, Alaska has the highest per-person healthcare costs in the U.S. And a third is energy. Fuel is more expensive in remote communities, and electricity can cost 3 to 5 times more in rural areas than urban ones. And schools don't benefit from the state's power cost equalization program that offsets high electricity prices for rural residents. DeFeo says those issues complicate the funding puzzle.
Those things aren't really education policy issues, but they're certainly affecting how we're doing education policy, and they are affecting our spending. As long as those things are realities, you know, we should expect those to be a part of our education spending conversation.
So even as education costs as a whole continue to grow, DeFeo says the higher spending in Alaska doesn't keep pace with the nation, and she says that's a worrying sign for Alaska schools.
Alaska doesn't produce all of the teachers that it needs to hire every year, and so we're competing for teachers in a national market.
She says higher salaries, better benefits, and working conditions for teachers and school staff could help keep Alaska from falling further behind. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
Alaska State Troopers and Kenai Peninsula Borough Western Emergency Services responded to a plane crash near Anchor Point near milepost 155 on the Sterling Highway on Friday afternoon. Responders found Homer resident Kurt St. Jean deceased on arrival. They also found a woman on board and brought her to a local hospital to treat her injuries. The following day, two National Transportation Safety Board investigators completed an on-site investigation. Clint Johnson, chief of the Safety Board's Alaska Regional Office, said on Sunday that they are facing delays to recover the plane wreckage due to the inclement weather. He said they will bring the plane to Anchorage, where it will be inspected in a process that typically takes 12 to 15 months. A research plot at the Georgeson Botanical Gardens in Fairbanks has been planted with hazelnuts. The research will track the survivability and productivity potential for interior Alaska. KUAC's Robin reports.
As Alaska's climate changes, growers like Josh Smith are able to take advantage of longer seasons and warmer growing zones.
I grew up in North Pole, and I got used to people telling me that you can't grow this here, you can't grow that. In North Pole, it's just too cold, and in Fairbanks. But I started to realize, even as a kid, that the extremes that I read about in the 70s, the 80s, I wasn't necessarily seeing those in North Pole.
Smith has been growing things since childhood, and he wanted to try planting crops that have never grown here before.
With climate change, I'm like, well, I kind of want to experiment, try some new crops, especially getting more people talking about food security in the face of climate change.
And now one of those experiments is hazelnuts. Definitely not a crop you associate with Alaska. But Smith says they're pretty resilient. Smith learned about them after joining the Air Force and was stationed in North Dakota.
I got to see the possibilities of what could be grown in a cold climate with short, intense growing seasons.
When Smith returned to Alaska, he brought some North Dakota hazelnuts with him and sprouted them in his home in South Central Alaska. He's becoming known as a plant hobbyist and even has the email name Alaska Plant Guy.
So I post a lot of my goofy plant experiments, like my English walnuts, my sweet cherries. I post them on Facebook, so I nerded out talking about experimental fruits and nuts.
He got to be known at the Matanuska Experimental Farm, and they offered to host an experimental plot of hazelnut trees. Smith's North Dakota hazelnuts were bred in Zone 3. Zone 1 is the coldest, like what we have in Fairbanks. The plants aren't really trees. They top out at about 15 feet as bushy shrubs. They take about 8 years to produce nuts. Each plant produces both male and female blossoms, but they don't self-pollinate. So you need multiple trees if you want to produce nuts. The project at the Matanuska farm is called the Future Crops Initiative. They planted 150 hazelnut trees there last July.
I grew a bunch of extras because I wanted to make sure I had enough for that project. Well, it turns out I had almost 50 to 60 extra hazelnut plants.
Well, what does one do with extra plants? One brings them to the Tanana Valley.
There's so many microclimates from your zone 1 down the valley floor where it gets to negative 50 to negative 60 every year. There's some areas that banana belts up in the hills where it doesn't even get below negative 35. So there's a whole slew of microclimates. And with these being zone 3 hazelnuts, I'm like, there's bound to be some that are going to survive somewhere in Fairbanks.
The Georgeson Botanical Garden is on a hill at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, which makes for a good experimental plot. In September, Glenna Gannon, Assistant Professor of Sustainable Food Systems at UAF, and Katie DeChristina, the garden's manager, planted two plots separated by about 100 feet in elevation.
Now it's a matter of figuring out hazelnuts are made of tough enough stuff to survive in Fairbanks.
With any luck, there may be hazelnuts to consume in a few years. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
Governor Mike Dunleavy issued a disaster declaration for Little Diomede in a press release last week in response to the partial collapse of the city building at the end of November. The shifting of the building forced the school to close indefinitely and switch students to online learning. According to the release, a structural engineer from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities and representatives from COWERIC, the Bering Straits Regional Tribal Consortium, assessed the situation in Little Diomede on December 3rd. The release says that DOT and PF engineers suspects that the ground settling and the age of the city building contributed to the collapse. a member of the Alaska State Defense Force in Little Diomede, is now in communication with the State Emergency Operations Center. The city building, which housed the city offices, the fire department, and the post office, is undergoing equipment removal. A temporary post office has been established in the old clinic, according to the release. Jeremy Zadek, a public information officer for the Alaska Division of Homeland Security, says that contractors are actively demolishing the building, but the timeline is heavily dependent on weather conditions. The village is only accessible by air in the winter and by boat when the ice thaws. A Kisilov couple is accused of illegally transporting game hunters in northwest Alaska after a multi-year investigation by the National Park Service. According to federal court documents, 66-year-old Matthew Owen transported caribou hunters in the Noatak National Preserve, located about 100 miles north of Kotzebue, in 2019 and 2020. It is illegal for non-local hunters to hunt caribou and moose within certain areas of the preserve between the Noatak and Kobuk rivers. Owen is currently charged with 10 counts of engaging in business without a permit, 3 counts of failure to follow a lawful order, and 1 count of false information. His wife, Julie Owen, 60, is charged with 1 count of providing false information and 1 count of permit violation. If convicted, the couple face 6 months of imprisonment and a $5,000 fine for each count. They could also be required to pay all the costs of the legal proceedings as part of their sentence.
It's decision week for the Federal Reserve. I'm Nova Sapo with the Marketplace Minute. For the final time this year, Fed officials meet this week to decide the direction of interest rates. They're widely expected to keep rates where they are. Goldman Sachs is expecting a rate cut by next summer. Another energy giant is gobbling up a smaller oil and gas producer. Occidental Petroleum is buying Crown Rock in a deal valued at $12 billion. Crown Rock focuses on shale oil production through fracking in Texas. Chevron and ExxonMobil have recently announced similar deals. AAA says travel between Christmas and New Year's will continue to rebound later this month, but remain below pre-pandemic levels. More than 7.5 million people are expected to travel by air, more than 100 million by car. I'm Nova Sapo with the Marketplace Minute.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the 11th day of December, the year 2023. The sun rose today at 9:43 a.m. We'll set again at 4:22 p.m., giving us 6 hours and 39 minutes of glorious daylight, a loss of 1 minute and 36 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high for this date was 47 degrees, set in 2013, and our record low was 0, set in Chile, 1975. Currently, a relatively balmy 32 degrees with a few clouds out there. Southwest winds at 8 miles per hour and 10 miles of visibility at the airport. And the Weather Service is calling for sunny skies for the rest of the day. Southwest winds to 20, gusting to 30, with increasing clouds overnight. Southwest winds 5 to 10, low around 18 degrees tonight. And a slight chance of snow tomorrow. Looking at our local tides, we just had a high tide here on the east side, and we are just about to have a high tide over on the west side. Our high tide here in town happened at 12:08 and was 9.9 feet. And our next low tide will be at 7:07 and be minus 7/10. Over on the west side, your high tide will occur at 12:46 this afternoon and be 15.3 feet. And your low tide will happen at 7:36 p.m. and be minus 1.7 feet. Mariners, here is your weather forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak, Kodiak's east side, out to 15 nautical miles. Small craft advisory through tomorrow with southwest winds to 30, becoming southwest 25 tonight, 15-foot seas coming down to 13 feet tonight, with freezing spray tonight on our east side. For tomorrow, west 25, seas to 9 feet, and freezing spray. Offshore waters, 15 to 85 nautical miles into the Gulf. Marmot Island to Sit Connect. Small craft advisory through Tuesday as well, with southwest 30, seas to 17 feet offshore. West 25 tonight with 14-foot seas. And west 25 on Tuesday with 11-foot seas and freezing spray offshore tomorrow. Over in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory through tomorrow. Southwest 30 becoming west 30 tonight. 7-foot seas becoming 6 feet tonight. Freezing spray today, tonight, and tomorrow, where they will see northwest winds to 30 knots and seas to 7 feet. There will be a Board of Education regular meeting tonight, beginning at 6:30 p.m. in the District Services Conference Room, which is F-140 of the old high school wing. The agenda and packet can be viewed on board docs at the Kodiak Island Borough School District's website. For more information, contact the Secretary to the Board of Education at 907-486-7566. Tomorrow is another edition of Scuttlebutt, the Galley Tables Workshop for Youth. That happens at 4 to 5:30 p.m. in the Kodiak Public Library's Craft Room on Tuesdays. Scuttlebutt is a free weekly telling storytelling workshop for students in grades 9 through 12, where they practice building and sharing their stories with the help of experienced storytellers. Call 907-486-7396 for more information, or just show up at 4 p.m. tomorrow in the Kodiak Public Library's Craft Room. Also at the library on Wednesday, join them for an evening of armchair travel with Randy and Dan Bush. They are going to present Traveler's Destination, the Y Valley Walk. That's happening Wednesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m. at the Kodiak Public Library. Enjoy learning about their travels through the Y Valley of Great Britain. This walk is a long-distance footpath in Wales and England, following the course of the River Wye. Randy has prepared a slide presentation that will make you feel like you're there. Again, that's 6 to 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday. Also on Wednesday, the next edition of the FUN program, that's Families Understanding Nature, that's put on by the Kodiak Refuge Visitor Center. It features stories, crafts, and activities about nature and wildlife. And this Wednesday, December 13th, they will be looking at Aleutic visors. And remember, there will be no fun on the 20th or the 27th. Join us to talk about community support and caring for those with dementia at the Senior Center on Friday. That begins at 1 p.m. Respite care is provided for loved ones, and it's open to families, friends, care providers, and personal care assistants. For more info, please call the Hospice and Palliative Care of Kodiak at 907-512-0600. Coming up on Saturday, it's the Kodiak Harbor Lights Festival and Boat Parade. Join your friends and neighbors on Saturday to watch the Kodiak fleet decorated with holiday lights parade through the Near Island Channel. Boats will rendezvous at 6 p.m. north of the Near Island Bridge and proceed south through the channel to Pier 2 in the outer harbor. In the case of high winds that would prevent a parade, the public is still encouraged to walk the floats and see the decorated boats in both town at St. Paul Harbor and St. Herman Harbor over on Near Island, and they usually keep them up for a little while for a little fun touring after the event. For more information, contact the Kodiak Maritime Museum at 907-486-0384 or info at Kodiak Maritime Museum, all one word, .org. Caregivers of Kodiak's youngest community members are invited to the Diaper Distribution Center for free diapers and wipes on every fourth Friday of the month from 4 to 7 p.m. Diapers are available in all sizes in a first-come, first-served basis while supplies last. Size swaps are welcome. Bring outgrown diapers in good condition and trade them in for your baby's current size. And that's all located at 1910 East Rezanoff. The Diaper Distribution Center is a ministry of the Frontier Southern Baptist Church. The next one will be on December 22nd, 4 to 7 p.m. And the Health Facilities Advisory Board will be having their regular meeting today at 3 p.m. in the Providence Barometer Conference Room. Tomorrow, the Solid Waste Contract Committee will be having its regular meeting in the Borough Conference Room. That's happening at 1 p.m.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day. Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.